This is Audible.
Brilliant Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Last Town by Blake Crouch, performed by Paul Michael Garcia.
For my angels, Ansley and Adeline. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set, or who laid its cornerstone, while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy?" Job, chapter 38, verses 1 through 7, New International Version. We are the last of our kind, a colony of human beings from the early 21st century. We live in the mountains of what was once Idaho, in a town called Wayward Pines. Our coordinates are 44 degrees, 13 minutes, 0 seconds north, and 114 degrees, 56 minutes, 16 seconds west. Is anybody out there? Portion of a voice and Morse code radio transmission broadcast across all shortwave bands out of Wayward Pines superstructure on a continuous loop for the last 11 years. Prelude. David Pilcher. Superstructure. Wayward Pines. 14 years ago. He opens his eyes. Frigid, shivering, head throbbing. Someone stands over him wearing a surgical mask, their face a blur, words muddled. He doesn't know where he is or, for that matter, who he is. They lower a clear mask to his mouth and lean in close. The voice, a woman's, urges him, "Take a long, deep breath and keep breathing in." The gas he inhales is warm, concentrated oxygen. It flows down his windpipe and hits his lungs with a welcome burst of heat. Though her mouth is covered, the woman leaning over him is smiling at him with her eyes. "Better?" she asks. He nods. Her face grows sharper, and her voice, something familiar there. Not the timbre itself, but the way he feels toward it. Protective, almost paternal. "Does your head hurt?" she asks. He nods. "That'll pass soon." "I know you're feeling a lot of disorientation." Nod. "That's completely normal. Do you know where you are?" Headshake. "Do you know who you are?" Headshake. "That's okay, too. You've only had blood in your veins for 35 minutes. It usually takes a couple of hours to find your bearings." He stares up at the lights overhead, long fluorescence, far too bright. He opens his mouth. "Don't try to talk yet. Would you like me to explain what's happening?" Nod. "Your name is David Pilcher." He thinks that piece of information sounds right. The name feels like his own on a level he can't quite grasp, at the very least like a star that belongs in his sky. "You're not in a hospital. You haven't been in a car accident or suffered a heart attack. Nothing like that." He wants to say that he can't move, that he feels as cold as death and afraid. She continues, "You've just come out of suspended animation. Your vitals are all in the green. You've been sleeping for 1,800 years in one of 1,000 suspension units which you created. We're all so excited. Your experiment worked. The crew came through at a 97% survival rate, better by a few points than you projected, and with no critical losses. Congratulations." Pilcher lies on the gurney, blinking at the lights. The heart monitor he's attached to begins to beep faster and faster, but it isn't from fear or stress. It's exhilaration. Within 5 seconds, it all clicks in. Who he is, where he is, why he is. Like a camera racking focus. Pilcher reaches a hand up, heavy as a chunk of granite, and pulls the mask away from his mouth. He stares up at the nurse. For the first time in nearly 2 millennia, he speaks, raspy but clear.
"Has anyone gone outside?"
She removes her mask. It's Pam, 20 years old and ghost-like in the wake of her long, long sleep. And yet, still so very beautiful. She smiles. "You know I wouldn't let that happen, David. We waited for you." 6 hours later, Pilcher is on his feet and moving unsteadily down the level 1 corridor, flanked by Ted Upshaw, Pam, Arnold Pope, and a man named Francis Levin. Levin's official title is Steward of the Superstructure, and he's talking a mile a minute. "Had one hole breach in the arc 783 years ago, but the vacuum sensors caught it," Pilcher says. "So our provisions. I'm running a battery of tests, but everything appears to have come through fully preserved." "How much of the crew has been awakened?" "Only 8, counting us." They reach the automatic glass doors that open into the 5 million square foot cavern that serves as a warehouse for provisions and building supplies. Affectionately called the Ark, it is one of the great feats of human engineering and ambition. A damp, mineralized smell pervades. Massive globe lights hang down from the ceiling, stretching back into the Ark as far as the eye can see. They walk toward a Humvee parked at the entrance to a tunnel, and already Pilcher is breathless, his legs threatening to seize up with cramps. Pope drives. The tunnel's fluorescent luminaries aren't yet operational, and the Humvee plunges down the steep 15% grade into abject darkness, nothing to light its way but the lonely headlights blazing off the wet rock walls. Pilcher rides up front beside his henchman. The disorientation is still present, but retreating. His people have told him that the suspension lasted 1,800 years, but with each breath he takes, that seems less and less possible. In truth, it feels as though only hours have passed since that New Year's Eve party in 2013, when he and his entire crew drank Dom Pérignon, stripped naked, and climbed into their suspension pods. His ears release pressure as they descend. His stomach tingles with nervous energy. Glancing over his shoulder, Pilcher stares at Levin in the back seat, a lithe young man with the face of a baby but the eyes of a sage.
"We're going to be safe breathing in this atmosphere," Pilcher asks. "It has altered," Levin says, "but only slightly. Nitrogen and oxygen, thank God, are still the main components, but the makeup is now 1% more oxygen, 1% less nitrogen. Greenhouse gases have returned to pre-industrial age levels."
"I trust you've already begun to depressurize the superstructure."
"That was the first order of business. We're already sucking in air from outside."
"Any other pertinent bits?"
"It'll be a few days until our systems are fully powered up and debugged."
"Where does our electron clock place us in terms of the Christian calendar?"
"Today is February 14th, 3813 in the year of our Lord." Levin grins. "Happy Valentine's Day, all."
Arnold Pope brings the Humvee to a full stop, its high beams shining against the backside of the titanium portal that has protected the tunnel, the superstructure, and all who sleep within from the world outside. Pope kills the engine, leaves the lights running. As they all step out of the truck, Pope walks around to the back and opens the cargo doors. He takes a pump-action shotgun off the rack.
"For God's sake, Arnie," Pilcher says, "always the pessimist."
"That's why you pay me the big bucks, right? If it were up to me, I'd have my entire security team rolling with."
"No, we're keeping this intimate for now."
Levin says, "Pam, would you mind bringing your flashlight over?"
As she shines the beam onto the release wheel, Pilcher says, "Let's just wait a beat." Levin straightens. Pope heads over. Ted and Pam turn to face him. Pilcher's voice is still gravelly from the drugs that revived him. He says, "Let's not let this moment pass us by." His people study him. "Do you all understand what we've done? We just completed the most dangerous, daring journey in human history. Not across distance, across time. You know what waits on the other side of this door?" He lets the question hang. No one bites. "Pure discovery."
"I don't follow," Pam says.
"I've said it before, I'll say it again. This is Neil Armstrong going down the steps of Apollo 11 to stand on the moon for the first time. The Wright brothers testing their flyer at Kitty Hawk. Columbus walking ashore into the New World. There's no telling what lies on the other side of this portal."
"You predicted that humanity would become extinct," Pam says.
"Yes, but my prediction was just that. A prediction. I could have been wrong. There could be 10,000-foot skyscrapers out there. Imagine a man in 213 A.D. stepping into 2013. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. Albert Einstein said that. We should all savor this moment."
Levin turns his attention to the release wheel, which he begins to crank counterclockwise. When it finally locks into place, he says, "Sir, care to do the honors?" Pilcher approaches the portal. Levin says, "It's this latch, right here." Pilcher throws the latch. For a moment, nothing happens. The lights of the Humvee cut out. Only the beam of Pam's meager flashlight cuts through the darkness. Something under their feet begins to groan, like an old ship creaking. The heavy portal door shudders and begins to creak open. And then light spills across the pavement, spreading toward them in a radiant stain. Pilcher's heart is pounding. It is the most thrilling moment of his life. Snow whisks inside across the pavement, and a shot of bone-chilling cold knifes into the tunnel. Pilcher squints against the light. When the 4-foot portal is fully open, it frames the world beyond like a picture. They all see a boulder-strewn pine forest in the midst of a snowstorm. They move into the forest, tracking through a foot of soft powder. It is beyond quiet, the sound of falling snow like a whisper. After 200 yards, Pilcher stops. The others stop too. He says, "I think this is where the road into Wayward Pines used to be." They're still standing in a dense pine wood, no sign of a road anywhere. Pilcher pulls out a compass. They head north into the valley. Pines tower above them. "I wonder," Pilcher says, "how many times this forest burned and regrew." He's cold. His legs ache. He's certain the others feel the same weakness, but no one complains. They trudge on until the trees break. How far they've come, he can't be sure. The snow has let up, and for the first time, he sees something familiar. Those massive cliff walls that almost 2,000 years ago surrounded the hamlet of Wayward Pines. It surprises him how much comfort he finds in seeing these mountains again. 2 millennia is a long time when it comes to forests and rivers, but the cliffs look virtually unchanged, like old friends. Soon their party is standing in the dead center of the valley. There's not a single building left, not even ruins. Levin says, "It's like the town was never even here."
"What does this mean?" Pam asks.
"What does what mean?" Pilcher says.
"That nature has taken back over. That the town is gone."
"Impossible to say. Maybe Idaho is now a huge preserve. Maybe Idaho doesn't exist anymore. We have a lot to learn about this new world." Pilcher looks for Pope. The man has wandered 20 yards away into a clearing, where he kneels down over the snow.
"What is it, Arnie?"
He waves Pilcher over. As the group gathers around Pope, he points down at a set of tracks.
Human? Pilcher asks.
They're the size of a man's footprint, but the spacing is all wrong.
How so?
Whatever this thing is, it was moving on four limbs. See?
He touches the snow.
Here are the hind legs. There are the forelegs. Look at the distance between tracks. That's one hell of a gait.
In the southwest corner of the valley, they find a collection of stones poking up through the ground, scattered through a grove of scrub oak and aspen trees. Pilcher squats down to inspect one of the stones, brushing the snow away from the base. Once a block of polished marble, time has worn it rough.
What are these? Pam asks, running her hand across the top of another similar stone.
The ruins of a cemetery, Pilcher says. The etchings have been eroded. This is all that's left of 21st century wayward pines.
They walk home back toward the superstructure. Everyone weak. Everyone cold. The snow picks up again, a shroud of white falling against the backdrop of cliffs and evergreens.
Doesn't particularly feel like anyone's home, Levin says.
One of the first things we'll do, Pilcher says, is send out the drones. We'll fly them to Boise, Missoula, even Seattle. We'll know if there's anything left.
They follow their own tracks back into the woods. As a silence descends on the group, a scream rises up in the valley behind them, frail and haunting, echoing off the snow-hidden peaks. Everyone stops. Another scream answers, lower in pitch, but containing that same mix of sadness and aggression. Pope opens his mouth to speak when a veritable nation of screams rises up out of the woods all around them. They hurry through the snow, jogging at first, but as the screams close in, everyone accelerates to a full-on sprint. 100 yards out from the tunnel, Pilcher's legs are finished and sweat pours down his face. The others have reached the portal. They're climbing through, shouting at him to run faster, their voices commingling with the shrieks behind him. His vision blurs. He glances back, glimpses movement in the pines, pale forms pursuing him on all fours through the trees. He's gasping for air, thinking, I'm going to die my first day out of suspension. The world goes black, and his face is suddenly freezing. He hasn't lost consciousness. He's just face down in the snow, unable to move. As the approaching screams grow louder, he's suddenly hoisted out of the powder. From his new vantage point, draped over Arnold Pope's shoulder, he sees the woods joggling behind him and humanoid creatures bearing down, the closest within 15 feet. Pope shoves him through the titanium door, and as Pilcher crashes to the floor, Pope scrambles inside. Pilcher's face presses against the cold concrete.
Pope shouts, Get back! It's gonna be close!
The portal slams home. On the other side, a series of dull thuds crashes into the metal. Safe now, Pilcher's consciousness is ebbing. The last thing he hears before slipping under is Pam's voice cutting through the hysteria, shouting, What the fuck are those things?
1.
2 hours after Ethan Burke's revelation. Jennifer Rochester. The house was so damn dark. Jennifer tried the kitchen light out of instinct, but nothing happened. She felt her way around the fridge to the cabinet over the stove, opened it, and grabbed the crystal candlestick holder, candle, and the box of matches. She turned on the gas and struck a match to the back burner and set the tea kettle over the hissing blue flame. Lighting what was left of the candle, she sat down at the breakfast table. In her life before, she'd been a pack-a-day smoker, and God, could she use a cigarette right now, something to steady her nerves and her hands, which couldn't stop trembling. As her eyes filled with tears, the candlelight fractured. All she could think of was her husband, Teddy, and how far apart she felt from him. 2,000 years apart, to be exact. She'd always harbored hope that the world was still out there, beyond the fence, beyond this nightmare, that her husband was still out there, her home, her job at the university. On some level, it was that hope that had gotten her by all these years. Hope that one day she might wake up back in Spokane. Teddy would be lying beside her, still sleeping, and this place, Wayward Pines, would all have been a dream. She would slip quietly out of bed and go into the kitchen and cook him eggs, brew a pot of strong coffee. She would be waiting for him at the breakfast table when he stumbled out of bed in that disgusting robe, disheveled and sleepy and everything she loved. She'd say, "I had the strangest dream last night." But as she'd try to explain it, all that she'd experienced in Wayward Pines would slip back into the fog of forgotten dreams. She'd just smile across the table at her husband and say, "I lost it." Now her hope was gone. The loneliness was staggering. But underneath it simmered anger. Anger that this had been done to her. Rage at all the loss. The tea kettle began to whistle. She struggled to her feet, her mind racing. Lifting the kettle off the flame, the whistling died away and she poured the boiling water into her favorite ceramic mug in which she kept a tea infuser, perpetually filled with chamomile leaves. Tea in one hand, candle in the other, she moved out of the dark kitchen and into the hallway. Most of the town was still down at the theater, reeling from the sheriff's revelation, and maybe she should have stayed with everyone else. But the truth of it was that she wanted to be alone. Tonight, she just needed to cry in bed. If sleep came, great, but she wasn't exactly expecting it. She turned the corner at the banister and started up the creaking stairs, candlelight flickering across the walls. The power had gone out several times before, but she couldn't escape the feeling that tonight, of all nights, meant something. The fact that she'd locked every door and every window gave her some small, very small, peace of mind. Sheriff Ethan Burke. Ethan stared up at 25 feet of steel pylons and spiked conductors wrapped in coils of razor wire. The fence usually hummed with enough current to electrocute a person 1,000 times over, so loud you could hear it 100 yards away and feel it in your fillings at close proximity. Tonight, Ethan heard nothing. Worse still, the 30-foot gate stood wide open. Locked open. Shreds of mist skirted past like the front edge of an approaching storm, and Ethan gazed out into the black woods beyond the fence. Over the pounding of his heart, he heard shrieks beginning to echo in the forest. The Abbeys were on their way. David Pilcher's final words to him were set on repeat, "Hell is coming to you." This was Ethan's fault. Hell is coming to you. He'd made the mistake of calling that psycho fuck's bluff, "Hell is coming to you," and telling people the truth. And now everyone in town, his wife and son included, was going to die. Ethan sprinted back through the forest, the panic growing with every stride, every desperate breath. He weaved between the pines, now running alongside the quiet fence. His Bronco lay just ahead, and already the screams were louder, closer. Jumping in behind the wheel, he cranked the engine and sped off into the trees, pushing the suspension package to the limit and jarring the last few jags of glass out of what was left of the windshield. He reached the road that looped back into town and roared up the embankment, back onto pavement. Pinned the gas pedal to the floorboard. The engine wailed. He shot out of the trees and raced beside a pasture. High beams blazed across the billboard at the edge of town, showing a family of four waving, smiling those carefree 1950s shit-eating grins over the slogan, "Welcome to Wayward Pines, where paradise is home." Not anymore, Ethan thought. If they were lucky, the Abbeys would reach the dairy first, slaughtering their way through the cattle before tearing into town. There it was, straight ahead, the outskirts of Wayward Pines. On a clear day, the town defined perfection. Neat blocks of brightly colored Victorian houses, white picket fences, lush green grass. Main Street looked like something built for tourists to wander down and dream of retiring here to live the good life, the quaint life. The mountain walls that surrounded the town promised shelter and security. At first blush, nothing about it felt like a place you couldn't leave, a place where you'd be killed for even trying. Except tonight. Tonight the houses and buildings stood ominously dark. Ethan turned onto 10th Avenue and screamed through 7 blocks before ripping out onto Main so hard the right side wheels lifted off the ground. Up ahead, at the intersection of Main and 8th, the entire town stood where he'd left them, out in front of the Opera House. 400-and-something souls waiting around in the dark like they'd been kicked out of a ball en masse, still dressed in their ridiculous costumes from the fete. Ethan shut off the car and climbed out. It was eerie to see Main Street in the dark, all that storefront glass lit only by torchlight. There was the Steaming Bean, Wooden Treasures, Kate and Harold Ballinger's toy store, the Wayward Pines Hotel, Richardson's Bakery, the Biergarten, the Sweet Tooth. Wayward Pines Realty Associates, where Ethan's wife, Teresa, worked. The noise of the crowd was overwhelming. People were emerging from their disbelief and shock in the wake of Ethan's decision to tell them all the truth about Wayward Pines, beginning to talk to one another in some ways for the first time. Kate Ballinger hurried over. It was Kate and her husband, Harold, who'd been on the execution block for tonight's fate, whose lives his revelation had momentarily saved. Somebody had done a fast-stitch job on the gash above her left eye, but her face was still streaked with blood, which had also matted her prematurely white hair. Kate's disappearance in Wayward Pines had brought Ethan to this town 2,000 years ago. In another lifetime, they had worked together in the Secret Service. They'd been partners. For a brief, scorching window, they'd been more than partners. Ethan took Kate by the arm and hustled her around to the back of the Bronco, out of earshot from the crowd. She'd almost died tonight, and as Ethan stared down at her, he could see in her eyes that she was holding everything together by a fraying thread. He said, "Pilcher killed the power."
"I know."
"No, I mean, he killed the power to the fence as well. He opened the gate." She studied Ethan, as if trying to process exactly how bad a piece of news she'd just received.
"So things," she said, "the aberrations,
they can walk right into town now.
And they're coming. I heard them at the fence."
"How many?"
"I don't know. Even a small group could be catastrophic."
Kate glanced back at the crowd. The conversations were dying out, people edging closer to hear the news.
"Some of us have weapons," she said. "A few have machetes. That's not going to cut it."
"Can't you reason with Pilcher? Call him back. Change his mind."
"We're past that point."
"Then we get everyone back inside the Opera House," she said. "There are no windows. Just one exit on either side of the stage. Double doors leading in. We'll barricade ourselves in."
"What if we are under siege for days? No food, no heat, no water, and there's no amount of barricading that will keep the Abbeys out indefinitely."
"Then what, Ethan?"
"I don't know. But we can't just send people back to their homes."
"Some have already gone. I told you to keep everyone here. I tried.
How many went home?
50, 60?
Jesus."
Ethan spotted Teresa and Ben, his precious family, moving toward him through the crowd. He said, "If I can get into the superstructure, if I can show Pilcher's inner circle who the man they serve really is, then we might have a chance."
"So go, right now."
"I'm not leaving my family. Not like this. Not without a real plan."
Teresa reached him. She'd pulled her long blonde hair into a ponytail, and both she and Ben were dressed in dark clothing. Ethan kissed her, then ruffled Ben's hair. Ethan could already see the man his 12-year-old boy might become shining through his eyes. Maturity, threatening.
"What did you find?" Teresa asked him.
"Nothing good."
"I've got it," Kate said. "We need to be somewhere safe while you break into the superstructure."
"Right.
Somewhere protected? Defendable? Already stockpiled with provisions?"
"Exactly."
She smiled. "I might actually know of a place like that."
Ethan said, "The Wanderer's Cavern."
"Yeah."
"That might work.
I have guns at the sheriff's station. Go get them. Take Brad Fisher with you. She pointed to the sidewalk. He's right over there.
How are we going to get this many people up the cliff?
I'll separate everyone into groups of 100, Kate said. With each group led by someone who knows the way.
What do we do about the ones who went home? Teresa asked.
She was answered with a single distant scream. The crowd had been murmuring. Now everyone went silent. The sound had come from south of town, a fragile, malignant moan. Nothing that could be explained or described, because you didn't just hear it. You felt its meaning. And its meaning was this: hell is coming. Ethan said,
It's going to be hard enough to protect the people who stayed.
So they're just on their own?
We're all on our own now.
He went around to the front passenger seat of the Bronco, reached in, and grabbed the bullhorn. Handing it to Kate, he asked,
You got this?
She nodded. Ethan looked at Teresa. I want you and Ben to stay with Kate.
Okay.
Ben said,
I'm coming with you, Dad.
I need you with Mom.
But I can help you.
This is how you help me. Ethan turned to Kate. I'll catch up after the sheriff's office. Come to the little park at the north end of town.
With the gazebo?
That's the one.
Brad Fisher, Wayward Pines's only lawyer, sat awkwardly in the destroyed front passenger seat of Ethan's Bronco, clutching the handle on the door as Ethan hit 60 on First Avenue. Ethan glanced over.
Where's your wife?
Brad said,
We were in the theater. You were talking, telling us everything. Then I looked over and Megan was just gone.
Ethan said, Considering what she was teaching the children behind their parents' backs, she probably figured people would see her as a traitor, feared for her life. How do you feel about her now? This seemed to catch Brad off guard. Normally, he was spit-shined and clean-shaven, the model of a competent young lawyer. Now, he scratched at the sandpaper on his chin.
I don't know. I never really felt like I knew her or that she knew me. We lived together because we were told to. We slept in the same bed. Sometimes we slept together.
Sounds like a lot of real marriages.
Did you love her?
Brad sighed.
It's complicated. You did the right thing, by the way. Telling us?
If I'd known he'd kill the power to the fence.
Don't go there, Ethan. You can't play that game.
You did what you believed was right. You saved Kate and Harold. Showed us all what our lives are really worth.
I wonder, Ethan said, how long that sentiment is going to last once people start dying.
The high beams fired across the dark sheriff's station. Ethan steered over the curb and took the Bronco right up the sidewalk. He brought it to a stop a few feet from the entrance and climbed out, clicking on a flashlight as he and Brad reached the double doors. Ethan unlocked them, propped one open.
What are we grabbing?
Brad asked as they ran through the lobby and turned down the corridor to Ethan's office.
Anything that shoots.
Brad manned the flashlight as Ethan pulled guns out of the cabinet and matched up the ammunition. He set a Mossberg 930 on the desk and pushed in 8 slugs. Fed 30 rounds into the magazine of a Bushmaster AR-15, topped off the mag for his Desert Eagle. There were more shotguns, hunting rifles, Glocks, a SIG, a .357 Smith & Wesson. He got 2 more handguns loaded, but it was all costing too much time. Kate Hewson. She grabbed hold of Harold's arm. Her husband was taking his group to an entrance a few blocks south, and she was leading hers to the north end of town. She threw her arms around his neck, kissed him long and deep.
I love you, she said.
He grinned, his silver hair sweat-plastered to his forehead despite the chill, the bruises on his face beginning to blacken.
Katie, if something happens, don't do that, she said.
What? Just get your ass to the cliff.
Several blocks away, something howled. As she moved toward the crowd of people waiting to follow her to safety, she glanced back and blew Harold a kiss. He snatched it out of the air. Jennifer. In her bedroom, Jennifer set the candle on the dresser and stripped out of the costume she'd worn to the fete. A black trench coat over red long underwear, topped off with a homemade pair of devil's horns. Her nightgown waited for her, hanging on the back of the door. Once in bed, she drank her chamomile and watched the candlelight dance across the ceiling. The tea went down warm. This had been her routine going on 3 years now, and she thought it had been wise not to break it tonight. When your world falls apart, cling to the familiar. She thought of all the other residents of Wayward Pines. They'd be going through some version of this, questioning all they'd been told, coming to terms with how grievously they'd been wronged. What would tomorrow bring? The window beside her bed was cracked, a stream of chill night air trickling in. She kept her room cold by choice, loving the feel of sleeping in a freezing room under a mountain of blankets. Through the glass, it was absolutely dark. The crickets had gone silent. She set her mug of tea on the bedside table and pulled the blankets up over her legs. There was only a half inch left of the candle on her dresser, and she didn't really want to be in total darkness just yet. Let it burn out on its own. She shut her eyes. Felt like she was falling. So many thoughts, so much fear pressing in. A tangible weight. Just sleep. She thought of Teddy. This last year she'd found herself remembering his smell, his tone of voice, what his hands had felt like on her body, far clearer than her memory of his face. She was forgetting what he looked like. Somewhere out in the darkness, a man began to scream. Jennifer straightened. She'd never heard screaming like this. Horror and disbelief and incomprehensible agony all compressed into a single outburst that seemed to go on and on and on. This was the sound of someone being killed. Had they gone ahead with Kate and Harold's execution anyway? The screaming stopped like a spigot had been turned off. Jennifer looked down. She was on her feet, standing on the cold hardwood floor. She went to the window, raised it several inches higher. Cold flooded in. Someone shouted inside a house nearby. A door slammed. Somebody sprinted through the alley. Another scream echoed through the valley, but this one was different. It was the same sound that monster had made inside the sheriff's Bronco. A god-awful, inhuman shriek. Other screams answered as a strong, pungent smell like rotten musk pushed into the bedroom, riding on the breeze. A low, throaty growl started down in her garden. Jennifer closed her window and threw the lock. She stumbled back, and as she sat down on the mattress, something came through the living room window downstairs. Jennifer jerked her head toward the door. The candle flame on the dresser winked out. She let out a gasp. The room was pitch black, her hand invisible in front of her face. She jumped to her feet and staggered toward the bedroom door, banged her knee on a hope chest at the foot of the bed, but managed to stay on her feet. She reached the door, heard the steps creaking as something came up the staircase. Jennifer eased the door shut and felt around for the lock. It clicked into the housing. Whatever had broken into her house was now out in the hallway, the floorboards groaning under its weight. More noise downstairs, clicks and screeches filling the house. She got down on her hands and knees and crawled across the floor as the footsteps outside her door drew closer. Flattening herself, she squeezed under the bed, heart pounding against the dusty hardwood floor. She could hear more of them climbing the stairs. The door to her bedroom exploded off the hinges. The footsteps of whatever entered her bedroom made a clicking sound on the hardwood, like claws or talons. She smelled it, stronger than ever, a potpourri of dead things, rot and blood, and an otherworldly stench beyond her understanding. She didn't make a sound. By the side of the bed, the floorboards cracked, as if the weight of something kneeling down. She held her breath. Something hard and smooth grazed her arm. She screamed and pulled back. Her shoulder suddenly felt cold. She put her hand to it. It came away wet. She'd been cut by something. Whispered, "Please, God." There were others in the room now. Oh, Teddy. She just wanted to see his face. One last time. If this was really the end. The bed lifted, one of the legs scraping across her side as it crashed into the wall. In total darkness, she couldn't move, paralyzed with fear. Her shoulder bled profusely, but she couldn't feel a thing, her body gone numb, mechanical, as the fight-or-flight response kicked in. They were near her now, standing over her, their alien respirations fast and shallow, like panting dogs. She put her head between her knees in the brace position. 2 weeks before they'd come on their fateful trip to Wayward Pines, she and Teddy had spent a Saturday at Riverton Front Park in Spokane. Thrown a picnic blanket down in the grass and stayed until dusk, reading their books and watching the white water spill over the falls. For a second, she captured his face. Not straight on, but from the side. Late sunlight fringing what hair he had left, glinting off the wire-rimmed glasses. He was watching the sun go down over the falls, content, in the moment. And she had been too. Teddy. He turned to look at her, smiling as the end came. Ethan. Brad was shoving the ammo-laden rucksacks through the busted back window as Ethan jumped in behind the wheel. He checked his watch. They'd burned 11 minutes. "Let's go," Ethan said. Brad yanked the door open and climbed onto the broken seat. Headlights blazed through the glass doors into the lobby of the sheriff station. Ethan glanced in the rearview mirror. Through the reddish glow of the taillights, a pale form streaked past. He shifted into reverse. They backed down the sidewalk, and Ethan's head hit the ceiling as the tires launched off the curb. Ethan braked hard, brought it to a dead stop in the middle of the road, and shifted into drive. Something struck the passenger side door, Brad screamed, and by the time Ethan looked over, Brad's legs were already sliding through the empty window frame. Ethan couldn't see the blood in the dark, but he could smell it, a strong, sudden waft of rust in the air. He pulled his pistol. The screams had gone silent. All he could hear was the fading scrape of Brad's shoes dragging across the pavement. Ethan grabbed the flashlight, which Brad had dropped between the seats, shined it out into the street. Oh my God. The beam struck an abbey. It was crouched on its hind legs over Brad, its face buried in his throat. It looked up, mouth blood dark, and hissed at the light with the venomous warning of a wolf protecting its kill. Behind it, the light showed more pale figures coming down the middle of the street. Ethan punched the gas. In the rearview mirror, a dozen abbeys chased the car on all fours. The one out in front came up alongside his door. It leapt at Ethan's window, just missed, hit the side of the car instead, and bounced off. Ethan watched it tumble across the street as he forced the pedal to the floor. When he looked back through the windshield, a small abbey stood 20 feet ahead of the grill, frozen in the headlights, teeth bared. Ethan braced. At contact, the bumper blasted the abbey straight back 30 feet. He ran it over and dragged it for half a block, the Bronco jarring so violently he could barely keep his grip on the steering wheel. The undercarriage finally spit it out. Ethan raced north. The rearview mirror showed a dark, empty street. He breathed again. Near the north end of town, Ethan turned west, headed several blocks toward Main until the headlights swiped across a line of people in the street, faces lit by a handful of torches. He steered the Bronco over the curb, left the keys in the ignition so the lights would keep burning. He went around to the back of the Bronco, lowered the tailgate, and grabbed one of the 3 loaded shotguns. Kate was standing beside an open trap door behind a bench, its underside constructed of 1x4 planks and rusted hinges, the top camouflaged with dirt and grass. She and another man were lowering people one by one underground. Their eyes met as he approached. He shoved a shotgun into their hands and looked back at the crowd, still 25 or 30 left to go.
"They need to be underground 5 minutes ago," Ethan said.
"Going as fast as we can."
"Where's Ben and Teresa?"
"Already down below."
"The Abbeys are here, Kate."
He saw the question in her eyes before she asked.
"Where's Brad?"
"They got him. And I'm telling you, we have a couple minutes tops, and then it's all over."
The crowd was moving with the efficiency of an evacuation. Orderly, no one talking, a hushed intensity in the air. Screams, human and inhuman, were erupting across the town with greater frequency. Ethan turned to the crowd. He said,
"I have a car full of weapons. If you ever owned firearms in your prior life, if you have any experience or comfort level whatsoever, come with me."
10 people stepped out of line and followed Ethan over to the back of the Bronco. Hector Gaither, the town pianist, stood among them. He was tall and lanky, salt-and-pepper hair with whitewashed wings, fragile, almost regal features. For the fate, he'd dressed up like a murderous fairy. Ethan asked, "What'd you shoot in your past life, Hector?"
"I used to go duck hunting with my father every Christmas morning."
Ethan handed him a Mossberg. "I loaded this up with 12-gauge slugs. It's going to kick a bit more than the birdshot rounds you're used to." Hector held it by the stock. So strange to see those soft, dexterous hands clutching a tactical shotgun. Ethan said, "You and I will go down last. I'll be right here with you." He turned his attention back to the arsenal. "I've got a few revolvers and a handful of semi-auto pistols left. Who wants what?"
2. Pilcher, Wayward Pines, 12 years ago.
It's morning, an autumn day. They didn't make skies this blue in his life before. You can look straight up into purple. The air so clear and clean it suggests a hyper-reality, the colors blindingly intense. Pilcher walks down the road into town. It was paved 2 weeks ago, and it still reeks of tar. He passes the new billboard where a worker rolls paint over the E in Paradise. When completed, the phrase will read, "Welcome to Wayward Pines, where paradise is home." Pilcher says, "Good morning. Good work."
"Thank you, sir."
The town has a long way yet to go, but the valley is beginning to look almost civilized. The forest has been mostly felled, save for a handful of trees left standing to line the streets and shade front yards. A concrete truck rumbles past. In the distance, new houses stand in various stages of completion. The residences were prefabricated prior to suspension. With all the foundations laid, the work seems to be accelerating, the town growing faster each day as homes begin to take shape. The school is nearly finished, the bottom 3 floors of the hospital framed. Pilcher arrives at the graded, unpaved corner of what will one day be 8th and Main. The valley hums with the distant whine of saws and the pressurized bursts of nails shooting into studs. The buildings that will soon line Main Street are fully framed, their yellow pine boards bright in the early sun. Arnold Pope drives up in a topless Jeep Wrangler. Pilcher's right-hand man climbs out of the Jeep and struts over.
"Come down to see the progress," Pope says.
"Magnificent, isn't it?"
"We're actually ahead of schedule. If all goes well, we'll have 170 homes completed before the snow flies and the exteriors of all the buildings, which means we'll be able to continue working on the interiors through the winter."
"So, when may I schedule the formal ribbon cutting?"
"Next spring."
Pilcher smiles, imagining it. A warm day in May, and the valley popping with blossoms and the baby greens and yellows of new leaves. A fresh start. Humanity's blank slate.
"Have you considered how you'll explain all of this to the first residents?"
They walk down the middle of the street, Pilcher eyeing the scaffolding fronting the building that will become the Opera House.
I imagine there will be some shock and disbelief at the outset, but once they understand what I've given them the chance to be a part of,
they'll fall on the ground thanking you, Pope says.
Pilcher smiles. A flatbed truck carrying a load of raw lumber rumbles past.
Can you fathom being given this opportunity?
Pilcher muses.
In the world we came from, our existence was so easy, and so full of discontent because it was so easy. How do you find meaning when you are one of 7 billion? When food, clothing, everything you need is just one Walmart away? When we numb our minds to sleep on all manner of screens and HD entertainment, the meaning of life, of our existence and purpose, becomes lost.
And what is that? Pope asks.
What is what?
Our purpose?
To perpetuate our species, of course. To reign over this planet. And we will again. Not in your or my lifetime, but we will. The people I bring out of suspension to populate my town won't have Facebook or iPhones, iPads, Twitter, next-day delivery. They'll interact like our species used to, face to face. And they'll live knowing they're the last of humanity, that outside our fence are 1 billion monsters that want to devour them. With that knowledge, they'll abide in a full understanding that in the fence of these enormous stakes, their lives have taken on incomprehensible worth. And isn't that all we want in the end? To feel useful? Of value?
Pilcher smiles as his town, his dream, comes to life before his eyes. He says,
"This place is going to be our Eden."
The Turners. Jim Turner kissed his 8-year-old daughter on the forehead and wiped away the tears that were streaming out of her eyes. She said,
"But I want you to stay with us."
"I have to go secure the house."
"I'm scared."
"Mommy's staying with you."
"Why are people screaming outside?"
"I don't know," he lied.
"Is it because of those monsters? We learned about them in school. Mr. Pilcher protects us from them."
"I don't know what they are, Jessica, but I have to go make sure you and Mommy are safe, okay?"
The little girl nodded.
"I love you, sweetheart."
"I love you too, Daddy."
He stood, put his hands on his wife's face, couldn't see her in the darkness, but he could feel her lips trembling, the wetness of tears running over them. He said, "You have water, food, a flashlight." He tried to make a joke out of it, even a pot to piss in. She grabbed his neck, put her lips to his ear.
"Don't do this."
"There's no other way, and you know it."
"The basement."
"It won't work. The boards are too long to go across the door." He heard their neighbors, the Millers, dying in their home across the street. "When it comes time to get out,
you'll break us out."
"I want nothing more. But if I'm not here to do it, use the crowbar. You'll have to wedge it into the jam."
"We should have stayed with the others."
"I know, but we didn't. And now we're doing the best we can. No matter what you hear in this bedroom, you stay in this closet and you don't make a sound. Cover her ears if..."
"Don't say that." "If what, Daddy? Oh, God, don't say that."
"I love you, my girls. Now I have to shut this door."
"No, Daddy."
"Quiet, Jess," he whispered.
Jim Turner kissed his wife. He kissed his daughter. Then he shut them into the bedroom closet on the second floor of their lavender-colored Victorian. His toolbox was already open on the floor. He flicked on his flashlight and chose a suitable 2x4 from the pieces of scrap lumber he'd carried in from the shed, remnants of a doghouse he'd built last summer. Those warm afternoons working in the backyard. Mrs. Miller's screaming jettisoned the memory into oblivion.
"No, no, 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 no! Oh, God!"
Jessica was crying in the closet, Gracie struggling to comfort her. Jim grabbed a hammer. He started nails on each end of the board. Screws would have been preferable, but there was no time. He held the pine board across the door frame and drove the nails into the studs. His mind wouldn't stop. He kept replaying what the sheriff had said, but he couldn't wrap his head around it. How could this be all that was left of humanity? By the time he had four boards nailed across the doorframe, the Millers had gone quiet across the street. He dropped the hammer, wiped his brow, dripping with sweat. Kneeling down, he put his lips to the closet door.
"Jessica? Gracie?"
"I can hear you,"
his wife said. "You're nailed in," Jim said. "Now I have to go find a place to hide."
"Be safe."
He put his hand on the door.
"I love you both so much."
She said something back, but he couldn't hear the words. Too muffled, too faint, too ruined by tears. Rising to his feet, he grabbed the flashlight and the hammer, the nearest thing to a weapon in his toolbox. At the bedroom door, he turned the lock and closed it gently behind him. The hallway was dark. The last half hour had been so filled with shouting and shrieks that the silence struck him wrong, like a lie.
"Where will you hide? How will you survive?"
He stopped at the top of the staircase. He was tempted to use the light, but feared it might draw attention. With a hand on the banister for a guide, he went slowly down the creaking steps. The living room stood in impenetrable shadow. Jim moved to the front door. He locked the deadbolt, but he had a feeling that didn't matter. From what he'd seen, these things were running through the windows.
"Stay inside? Go?"
On the other side of the door, he heard something scrape. Leaned into the peephole. There were no street lamps working, but he could actually see outside, the pavement and the picket fences and the cars just faintly illuminated by residual starlight. Three of those things were crawling up the flagstones that led from the picket fence to the front door. He'd caught glimpses of them streaking down the street from his second-floor bedroom window, but he hadn't yet seen one up close. None of them were larger than he was, but their muscle tone was extraordinary. They looked like humanity wrapped in the trappings of a monster. Equipped with talons instead of fingers, teeth designed for cutting and tearing, they brandished arms that seemed too long in proportion to the rest of their body, longer even than their legs. He said under his breath, like a prayer, "What the hell are you?" They reached the porch. Fear suddenly wore him like a glove. He backed away from the door, moving through the dark again, between the sofa and the coffee table, and then into the kitchen, where the starlight filtered through the window over the sink just sufficiently to brighten the linoleum and light the way. Jim set the hammer on the counter and took the back door key off the nail beside the door. Something crashed into the front door as he worked the key into the lock. A wood-splintering, lock-rattling collision. He turned the key, the deadbolt retracting, ripped open the back door as the front door punched open. The steps leading up to the second floor, to the bedroom, to the closet where his girls were in hiding, would be the first thing those monsters saw. Jim walked several steps back into the kitchen and said, "Hey guys, over here!" An eardrum-riving shriek filled the house. He couldn't see a thing, but he heard those creatures slamming through tables and chairs as they came for him. He tore back through the kitchen, shutting the door after him and launching down the single step into his perfect square of grass. Past the doghouse, toward the fence. Glass broke behind him. As he reached the gate that opened into the alley, he glanced back, saw one of those things climbing through the kitchen window as the other two flung themselves into the back door. He flipped open the hasp and dug his shoulder into the gate. Ethan. The shrieks of the Abbeys were less than a block away as Ethan lowered himself through the opening, grabbed hold of the handle on the underside of the trap door, and pulled it closed over the top of him. The tunnel swelled with the reverberating noise of 100 voices down below, loud enough to drown out the Abbeys. He searched, but there was no lock